Imagine dropping like 100 feet down into this freezing, turbulent ocean current, just miles away from any
Oh,
coastline.
yeah, out in the middle of absolutely nowhere.
Right. You are completely surrounded by this deep, just bottomless blue water. And then suddenly, the swirling, chaotic tornado of, I don't know, like 500 hammerhead sharks just emerges right out of the gloom.
Which is an incredible image.
It really is. But I mean, to a lot of people listening right now, that scenario probably sounds like a total
Oh,
nightmare.
totally. Pure terror for most people.
Yeah, exactly. But for a really specific, dedicated group of scientists and photographers, what I just described is basically the absolute holy grail of the ocean. So, welcome to today's deep dive.
Thanks for having me.
Always great to be here. Today, we are throwing out all those tired Hollywood monster movie cliches, and we're plunging straight into the actual awe-inspiring reality of the ocean's ultimate apex predators.
Because honestly, it is a radically different reality than, what we usually see on screen.
Oh, for sure.
For this deep dive, we're pulling from a really fantastic piece of writing called Apex Predators, the world's premier shark diving destinations. And our mission today is to kind of decode the mechanics behind eight very specific underwater environments. We want to figure out exactly why these spots act as such massive magnets for, well, three distinct types of people, really. You've got your thrill-seeking scuba divers, your meticulous marine biologists, and of course, dedicated underwater photographers.
Before we jump into the actual locations, though, I have to point out this dry little editorial crisis in the source text that honestly gave me a laugh.
Oh, the numbering thing.
Yes. So the title loudly promises the top eight shark dive destinations, but then right in the opening paragraph, the text formally announces it's going to cover, quote, seven of the world's most compelling spots.
And then it just keeps going.
Right. Without missing a single beat, it proceeds to list exactly eight
That's
locations.
a classic proofreading mystery.
It really is. We love it. But don't worry, if you're listening, you aren't getting shortchanged today. We
Right,
are
right.
covering all eight.
We definitely are. And the key to understanding why these eight spots are so legendary really comes down to this idea of intersectionality.
How do you mean?
Well, it's not just about the sharks themselves. It's about how the unique geography, the water temperature, and the visibility fundamentally change the behavior of the animals. And because the behavior changes, that completely alters what humans can actually do when they get in the water with them.
Okay, that makes a little sense. So let's start with the undisputed A-listers, right? The ocean's most recognizable silhouette, the great whites.
Oh, yeah. The icons?
Right. And the text highlights two legendary environments to see them, but they are polar opposites. First, we have Gansby in South Africa, and then we have Guadalupe Island in Mexico.
Completely different vibes.
Literally night and day. So looking at Gansby first, the text describes it as having this really dramatic offshore geography, freezing cold water, rough seas, and incredibly murky, moody lighting.
Yeah, it's intense.
It really is. It delivers this raw, unpolished experience.
And that intensity is entirely driven by the environment. Like, for marine biologists, that rugged, low visibility setting is an absolute gold mine.
Really? Even though they can hardly see anything.
Yeah, because Gansby is where researchers go to study raw predator-prey dynamics. I mean, think about the mechanics of a hunt, right? If you're a massive predator, murky water is actually your greatest asset.
Because they can't see you coming.
Exactly. It acts as natural camouflage. So scientists go there to observe how great whites use that limited visibility to basically ambush seal colonies from the depths.
Wow.
They're out there studying these explosive, high-energy breaching events that, just wouldn't be possible if the prey could see the sharks coming from a mile away.
Okay, let's unpack this a bit. Because if Gansby is like shooting a gritty, unpredictable indie documentary out in the elements, right, where the environment is the hunting
I
strategy,
like that analogy.
thanks. Then Guadalupe Island in Mexico is basically your high definition, highly controlled studio shoot.
Very much so.
The text points out that divers travel to Guadalupe specifically for exceptionally clear water and very predictable conditions. You have regulated operators, stationary cages, crystal clear
It's
visibility.
perfect for cameras.
Exactly. I totally get why underwater photographers prefer that. They want the clear water for clean backgrounds. They want to use longer lenses without all that, floating particulate getting in the way.
Right.
But here's my question. Why does water clarity and predictability matter so much for the biologists? I mean, shouldn't they want to see the raw hunting behavior like in South Africa?
That's a great question. And what's fascinating here is how the physical environment basically dictates the precise category of data researchers can gather.
Okay.
Yes, hunting is important, but it's really only one aspect of a shark's life. In that clear, predictable studio setting of Guadalupe, scientists don't have to deal with the chaos of a breaching ambush.
They can actually breathe for a second.
Right. Instead, they can act as behavioral naturalists. Because the water is so pristine, they can map a shark's cruising style from a long distance.
Oh, wow.
They can track the really subtle body language of how a great white investigates a cage, or how multiple sharks establish a social hierarchy around a bait line.
So they're getting the small details.
Exactly. They are gathering high-resolution behavioral data, all these subtle nuances of communication and curiosity that would just be completely swallowed up and hidden by the rough waters in South Africa.
The environment literally shapes the science. You go to the murk to study the ambush, and you go to the clear water to study the personality.
Precisely.
That's incredible. So we've been talking about great whites, which usually means coastal areas, hunting near the surface, interacting with land. But what happens to the whole dynamic when you strip away the coastline entirely?
Just drop into the middle of nowhere.
Right. Dropping right into the deep, open ocean. That brings us to our next set of destinations. Cocos Island in Costa Rica and the Galapagos Islands in Ecuador.
Yeah, so now we are moving from the coastal zones into the pelagic zones.
Pelagic meaning open ocean.
Right. When marine biologists use the word pelagic, they're talking about the open ocean, that deep blue wilderness far, far away from the shallow coastal reefs.
Got it.
Both Cocos and the Galapagos are these isolated remote outposts protruding out of incredibly deep water. They're defined by strong, sweeping ocean currents and really drastic temperature shifts.
And the text makes a huge point of saying these are not beginner dives.
Oh, absolutely not. They demand advanced scuba experience.
Yeah, I read the description of these dives, and frankly, it sounds like dropping into a deep blue washing machine.
That's a pretty accurate way to describe it.
But you aren't just looking at a single shark investigating a cage anymore. You're descending into massive, swirling aggregations of hundreds of schooling hammerheads, all set against this barren volcanic rock.
It's wild.
But here's where it gets really interesting, because I have to push back on the appeal of this a little bit.
Okay, it's here.
If you are listening to this right now, you might be wondering the same thing. You're telling me people willingly spend thousands of dollars to jump into freezing, turbulent, physically exhausting ocean currents just to cling to a volcanic rock in the middle of nowhere? Like, how is this the holy grail of diving?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, the sheer difficulty is exactly what makes it so valuable.
How so?
Well, for the thrill seekers, conquering those intense currents to witness a wall of hammerheads, that's like the ultimate badge of honor. But biologically speaking, those brutal currents are the lifeblood of the entire system.
Right, because of the nutrients.
Exactly. Deep ocean currents hit the sheer volcanic walls of these islands, and they get forced upward. It's called an upwelling.
Okay.
And this upwelling drags incredibly nutrient-rich, freezing water from the deep ocean all the way up to the surface.
So these isolated volcanic rocks act like massive magnets in an otherwise totally empty ocean.
Precisely. They are biological oases. And that is why marine biologists brave the washing machine, so to speak. They aren't there to study individual sharks.
They're looking at the big picture.
Right. They're studying macroscopic aggregation behaviors. Like, why do hundreds of hammerheads school together here specifically?
Yeah, how do they even find it?
Exactly. How do these massive animals navigate thousands of miles of empty ocean using magnetic field just to find this one specific rock? By diving in these difficult conditions, scientists get to observe an intact, thriving ecosystem in a completely pristine state.
So the physical toll of the dive is essentially the price of admission to see the wild ocean as it looked 1,000 years ago.
That's a beautiful way to put it.
Well, if clinging to a rock in a freezing upwelling sounds maybe a little too intense for a vacation.
Understandably.
The source text pivots to offer some highly structured, much more approachable alternatives. Let's look at this trio of specialized environments. Bimini in the Bahamas, Beca Lagoon in Fiji, and Malapascua in the Philippines.
This trio really showcases the incredible diversity of shark diving. Like, take Bimini, for instance.
Okay.
It is globally recognized for close, reliable encounters with tiger sharks. But unlike the punishing conditions of the Galapagos, Bimini is incredibly accessible.
Right. It's totally different.
Yeah, you're looking at shallow, warm, crystal clear turquoise waters right over a white sandy bottom.
Which, for a photographer, is a total dream scenario.
Oh, it's perfect.
Instead of shooting dark shapes in the murky deep blue, you get to isolate that beautiful striped pattern of a tiger shark against a bright, reflective sand background.
Exactly.
And then you have Baker Lagoon in Fiji, which the text highlights for its robust, healthy populations of reef sharks. Instead of the open blue, you're diving in a highly structured, vibrant coral reef environment.
The colors there are just...
unbelievable, right? The color contrast is off the charts. You have sleek, gray reef sharks weaving through neon pink and orange corals.
And Fiji's marine reserves also really demonstrate the success of local protection efforts. It gives biologists this controlled, localized environment to study how healthy shark populations maintain the balance of a reef ecosystem.
That's so important.
But the third location in this group, Malapascua in the Philippines, offers this behavioral phenomenon that is completely unique. It's widely considered the most reliable place on Earth to encounter thresher sharks.
Now, the thresher shark is such a strange, elegant animal. The text highlights their defining feature, this incredibly long, whip-like tail fin that makes up basically half their body length.
That's very distinctive.
Right. And divers travel to Malapascua specifically to do these very early morning dives at deep underwater seamounts, which act as, well, cleaning stations.
Yeah, cleaning stations.
The text calls it that, and it sounds exactly like an underwater car wash. But honestly, I am stuck on the mechanics here.
What do you mean?
Well, if you are a 15-foot apex predator coming in from the deep ocean, why on earth would you gently hover over a reef instead of just, you know, eating the tiny fish swimming right up to your mouth?
Huh, right. It raises a really important question about survival strategies. It basically comes down to a biological truce.
A truce?
Yeah. Pelagic sharks, like threshers, they spend their lives roaming the open ocean and they accumulate ectoparasites. These are tiny, harmful organisms that attach to their skin and gills.
Right.
And these sharks need to be cleaned to stay healthy. So they actually navigate to these specific underwater seamounts where specialized little reef fish, like cleaner wrasses, live.
Okay, so they know where to go.
Right. The shark hovers in the current, drops its tail, and enters this almost trance-like state. And the tiny fish swim into the shark's gills and even its mouth, just eating all the parasites.
It's a trade-off. The tiny fish get a free meal, and the apex predator gets a vital spa treatment.
It's a perfectly calibrated mutualistic relationship. And for biologists, it's a massive opportunity.
Because they actually hold still.
Exactly. Out in the open ocean, a thresher shark is incredibly elusive. They use that long, whip-like tail to slash through schools of bait fish, stunning them with a shockwave before eating them. They are fast and really hard to track.
Wow.
But because they reliably return to this specific car wash in Malapascua every morning, researchers can easily log repeated sightings. They study interspecies cooperation, seasonal habitat use, and how open ocean predators basically rely on near-shore reef ecosystems to survive.
Okay, so we've covered the shallow, colorful tropical reefs of Fiji and the Bahamas. We've covered the deep, turbulent pelagic zones of Cocos and the Galapagos.
Right.
The text then takes us to a geographic location where these two completely different worlds essentially crash into each other. Let's talk about the Red Sea in Egypt.
Specifically focusing on Elphinstone and Brothers Island.
Yes.
The Red Sea is legendary for a reason. The underwater topography here is characterized by steep, vertical offshore reef walls that just plunge hundreds of feet straight into the abyss.
Just a sheer drop.
Yeah. And it's another environment with strong currents, so it's definitely better suited for experienced divers.
And the marine life is just a wild mix. You have oceanic white tips, you have hammerheads, occasionally even threshers. The text specifically refers to this region as a transition zone between tropical and temperate marine life.
Which is key.
So, what does this actually mean? How does a transition zone alter the physical behavior of the sharks hunting along these sheer walls?
Well, a transition zone occurs where different thermal masses of water meet. So in the Red Sea, you have the warm tropical surface waters colliding with colder currents, moving up those sheer vertical walls from the deep.
Okay.
That mixing creates a thermal gradient. Think of those massive vertical drop-offs as basically an underwater highway. Pelagic species that usually stay in the deep, temperate water are drawn right up to the edge of the vibrant, warm reefs to hunt.
So the wall is the boundary line, and all the predators are basically patrolling it.
Exactly. For scientists, it is a really rare opportunity to study crossover. They can observe how open ocean wanderers, like the oceanic whitetip, navigate steep structural geography. and how they interact with reef-dwelling species they wouldn't normally encounter.
That makes sense.
And for the photographers, this topography creates the ultimate suspense. You are literally hovering on the edge of a sheer cliff. On one side, you have a brightly lit coral wall, and on the other, just endless dark blue water.
Oh, man.
You're just waiting for a massive silhouette, like an oceanic white tip, to slowly materialize out of the void.
It's the ultimate dramatic reveal.
It really is.
Okay, so we've broken down the mechanics of the locations. We know where the murky hunting grounds are, the underwater car washes, the vertical highways. But the source text doesn't let us just parachute in.
No.
It outlines a very strict protocol. It shifts into a practical guide on how to be a respectful guest in their house, really, because surviving the environment is only half the battle.
The text makes it explicitly clear. Shark diving at this level is not about chasing danger or acting like a cowboy. It is about highly controlled, deeply respectful interaction. And the absolute foundation of that protocol is seasonality.
Timing is everything.
It really is. You can't just show up in South Africa or the Galapagos on any random Tuesday and expect a life-changing encounter. Water temperatures shift throughout the year, ocean currents change direction, and these animals migrate based on complex breeding cycles and food availability.
You have to follow the biology.
Exactly.
And once you actually get in the water, the rules of engagement are incredibly rigid. The text stresses that safety comes from using reputable dive operators and adhering to strictly observational practices.
Yes, very strict.
You have to maintain perfect buoyancy, meaning you aren't crashing into the reef or flailing your arms around. You avoid sudden movements. And you never, under any circumstances, attempt to touch or pursue the animal.
Right. You are a silent, neutral presence in the water column.
And that concept of being a witchful observer also extends to the photographers, right?
It does. The text gives a very specific technical tip, advising divers to use wide-angle lenses.
Why is that?
Well, the physics of water means that light and color drop off incredibly fast the further away you are from your subject.
Hmm.
You cannot use a long telephoto lens underwater like you would on, say, a land safari.
There's just too much stuff in the way.
Right. There's simply too much water and particulate between the lens and the subject. So a wide-angle lens allows the photographer to get physically close to the shark while still capturing the vastness of the blue water or the structure of the reef, which provides vital context.
But there is one piece of advice in this protocol section that I really want to challenge for a second.
Okay, what is it?
The text tells divers to, quote, think like a naturalist. It suggests that while you're diving, you should be making mental notes on the species, their behavior, your exact depth, the water temperature, the direction of the ocean current.
Yeah, gathering data.
But look, if I have spent a year saving up for a bucket list dream vacation to Fiji or the Red Sea, why should I be taking homework notes on water currents while I'm just trying to enjoy the majesty of the moment?
I mean, I hear you. It sounds like a chore. But participating in that homework is what elevates a tourist into a citizen scientist. The text argues that logging these specific environmental variables doesn't detract from the experience. It actually grounds you in it.
How so? It just feels like tracking data on a spreadsheet.
Because marine biologists cannot be everywhere at once. The ocean is simply too vast. When a recreational diver logs that they saw three female hammerheads at 80 feet in a 60-degree current moving north, that isn't just a memory in a journal.
Right.
That is a concrete data point.
Yeah.
Dive operators and researchers aggregate that crowdsourced data to track macro trends, like shifting migration routes due to climate change or changes in seasonal habitat use.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, when you actively note the mechanics of the ecosystem around you, you stop passively floating through a pretty landscape and become an active participant in understanding it.
You aren't just looking at the fish. You're actually helping to map the ocean. I love that shift in perspective. So, to you listening right now, thinking about everything we've just unpacked, out of all these incredible extremes, the freezing nutrient-rich upwellings of the Galapagos, the murky ambush zones of South Africa, the biological car washes of the Philippines, or the vertical drop-offs of the Red Sea, which environment would you want to drop into? Where do you want to test your limits?
Oh, man. It is an impossible choice. But looking at the source text as a whole, from the great whites to the threshers, a much larger narrative really emerges here.
What's that?
We are culturally conditioned to view sharks simply as monsters waiting in the dark, right? But the text insists that they are, quote, essential players in marine ecosystems.
Absolutely.
When you understand the mechanics of how they hunt, how they clean themselves, and how they navigate across oceans, you realize they are the keystone holding the entire food web together. Stepping into their environment as a respectful observer basically flips that whole cultural script.
They really are the architects of the reef and the deep blue. But taking that a step further, it leaves you wondering about our role in all this.
How do you mean?
Well, we usually think of ocean conservation as, you know, academic research papers or complex political treaties.
Right.
But if taking people out to these eight destinations, getting them to brave the currents, use their wide-angle lenses, and log their citizen science, if that is what generates the local economic funding to protect these fragile zones...
Oh, I see where you're going.
Yeah, then maybe the most powerful weapon we have against overfishing and habitat destruction isn't a textbook. Perhaps the most effective conservation tool on Earth is simply a diver's wide-angle photograph, proving to the world that a live shark is infinitely more valuable than a dead one.
That is a profound way to look at it. The ultimate thrill isn't surviving a monster. It's realizing you've been granted this incredible privilege to witness a fragile ecosystem at work. It's proving that the monster is actually a masterpiece worth saving.
Flipping the script from a horror movie to a preservation mission, I cannot think of a better place to leave it for today. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive.
Thanks for having me. This is great.
We hope it gave you a completely new perspective on the mechanics of the Big Blue and the predators that call it home. Keep exploring, stay curious, and we will catch you on the next one.